and had zero humanity towards the Palestinian people. I mean, the murder of the children should be stopped because we shouldn't be murdering children.
Yep.
It's not this sort of horse race. The horse race approach to genocide is just something I can't stomach.
When I talk to people, they almost offer a Hail Mary, like the students, you know, the children will save us all. But who's looking out for the students? You know, who's looking out for the kids that somehow are going to save us from this war nightmare that we're in? You know, there are laws, there are policies, there are things that we can do besides saying, well, gee, I hope those kids aren't too scared of going to jail. You know, I wish them well. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it is troubling. I mean, and if the students are all suspended and arrested and beaten up, they won't be there to save us. So, I mean, the student protesters need our solidarity. Even if we don't agree with their choice of words, always a choice of tactic. I mean, I was a college student once. I didn't always make the best decisions, but they're out there trying to stop a genocide in a society where 9/10 of our Congress, 9/10 of our local politicians, and like 9.9 of our media are all on board and fueling the flames, and they are getting beaten with batons, they're getting arrested, they're getting suspended, they're getting deported. They don't need our armchair extra analysis. They need our solidarity and our support, and they need us to get out on the streets too.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Chip Gibbons. He's policy director at Defending Rights and Dissent. They're online at rightsanddissent.org, and that's the place where you can get their Gaza First Amendment alert. Chip Gibbons, thank you so much for joining us once again on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you'd like more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, fair.org. The website is also the place to learn about our newsletter Extra, to hear previous episodes of Counterspin, and to show support for the show if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh, yeah, bringing you the
nuclear holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced...
I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Is Democracy Now!
The world must understand what is happening now in the northern Gaza Strip. Genocide, deliberate killing, anyone who moves in the street is shot at. It's clear that we are witnessing a real massacre against those present.
Israel's killed at least 115 Palestinians in Gaza over the past 2 days while intensifying its devastating siege on northern Gaza. We'll speak to Mohammed Shahada, a Palestinian writer and analyst from Gaza City. Then, we'll talk to the acclaimed best-selling author, Naomi Klein.
Too many of our people are worshiping a false idol once again. They are enraptured by it. They are drunk on it. They are profaned by it. And that false idol is called Zionism.
We'll speak to Naomi Klein about her new essay, How Israel Has Made Trauma a Weapon of War. We'll also talk to her about how conspiracy theories are impacting everything from the U.S. presidential election to hurricane relief efforts. Naomi Klein writes about conspiracies in her book, Doppelganger, A Trip into the Mirror World. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli forces have barred rescue teams from reaching Palestinians trapped under the rubble of collapsed buildings as Israel's siege on the northern Gaza Strip continues into its 18th day. On Monday, Israeli drones equipped with loudspeakers hovered over shelters for displaced Palestinians in Beit Lahia, blaring messages ordering them to flee through military checkpoints. Witnesses say Israeli soldiers entered the shelters, separated men from their families at gunpoint, and instructed women and children to move southward. The mass expulsion came amidst continued unrelenting Israeli attacks, including a strike on Beit Lahia that killed 15 Palestinians, including children. Gaza's health ministry reports at least 115 Palestinians have been killed over the last 48 hours. 500 more were wounded, bringing the reported number of people wounded in Israel's year-long war to more than 100,000, with nearly 43,000 killed and over 17,000 of them children, though both figures are likely to be a vast undercount. Northern Gaza's last three operational hospitals remain besieged, with more than 350 patients trapped inside Al-Ada, Indonesian, and Kamel Adwan hospitals. Dr. Marwan Al-Hams is director of Gaza's field hospitals.
Israel has not allowed the entry of any medicine, treatment, and medical supplies to the north of Gaza. In addition, the Israeli occupation is preventing the entry of food and nutrition for the medical teams and patients inside the hospitals, and it is directly targeting the hospitals.
Meanwhile, Gaza officials say Israeli forces have blocked the entry of more than a quarter of a million trucks carrying food and other vital aid into Gaza in the last year, as Israel is accused of using starvation as a weapon of war. In Lebanon, rescue workers are searching for civilians trapped under the rubble of their homes after Israel's military carried out more than a dozen strikes overnight on Beirut and its southern suburbs. At least 13 people, including a child, were killed, 57 others injured in an Israeli airstrike near the Rafik Hariri University Hospital, Lebanon's largest public medical center. At least 32 others were wounded in the attack, which caused major damage to the hospital. Separately, 50 medical workers and 15 patients were forced to evacuate the Al-Sahel Hospital in southern Beirut Monday after Israel's military claimed without evidence its home to a secret underground Hezbollah bunker containing hundreds of millions of dollars in cash and gold. Doctors insisted there's nothing hidden beneath the hospital and took reporters on a tour of its lower floors to disprove the claims. In Israel, air raid sirens sounded in Tel Aviv earlier today as Hezbollah fired a volley of rockets from Lebanon. Hezbollah said the attacks targeted a military base south of Tel Aviv, as well as a naval base northwest of Haifa. Meanwhile, Syrian media is reporting at least two people were killed and three others injured Monday when an Israeli guided missile slammed into a car in Damascus. Israel's military claimed responsibility, saying the strike killed the head of Hezbollah's money transfers unit. Israeli cabinet members and officials with the ruling Likud party called Monday for the reestablishment of illegal Israeli settlements in Gaza for the ethnic cleansing of the territory's Palestinian inhabitants. Far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir spoke from a conference of settler groups and ultranationalists near Israel's border with Gaza, where he declared, "We will encourage voluntary transfer of all Gazan citizens. We will offer them the opportunity to move to other countries because that land belongs to us," he said. The conference was organized by the Nahala Settlement Movement, whose leader, Daniela Weiss, said thousands of settlers are set to move to Gaza.
"We came here with one clear purpose. The purpose is to settle the entire Gaza Strip, not just part of it, not just a few settlements, the entire Gaza Strip from north to south. Thousands of people are ready to move to Gaza now as a result of the brutal massacre of the 7th of October. The Gaza Arabs lost the right to be here ever, so they will go to the different countries of the world. They will not stay here."
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has arrived in Tel Aviv for talks with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders. The State Department claims Blinken's trip is aimed at reviving failed Gaza ceasefire negotiations, yet the Biden administration continues to refuse calls for an arms embargo against Netanyahu's government amidst record U.S. military assistance to Israel. This is Blinken's 11th visit to the region since Israel launched its latest war on Gaza last October. Meanwhile, calls are growing for U.S. officials to investigate reports of the Israeli army using abducted Palestinians as human shields in Gaza, often forcing them to walk ahead of Israeli soldiers to inspect underground tunnels and buildings. The use of human shields is a war crime. In related news, a group of 60 House Democrats are demanding the Biden administration, quote, take immediate action to advocate for unrestricted, independent media access to Gaza, as Israel's blocked foreign journalists from entering over the course of its year-long assault on Gaza. Five falsely convicted New Yorkers who became known as the Central Park Five have filed a defamation lawsuit against Donald Trump after the Republican presidential candidate wrongfully suggested at last month's debate with Kamala Harris that the five confessed to a crime they did not commit. In 1989, the group of one Latino and four black teenagers were falsely accused and convicted of raping a white jogger in Central Park. As the boys faced a barrage of racism and police misconduct, Trump took out a full-page ad in the New York Times calling for reinstatement of the death penalty. Four members of the redubbed Exonerated Five, including New York City Council member Yusuf Salam, spoke at the Democratic National Convention in August. You can see our interview with Council member Salam at democracynow.org. The Muekwa Ohlone tribe is demanding an apology from Interior Secretary Deb Haaland and the National Park Service Police after members of the tribe were assaulted, arrested, and violently removed from the National Mall by federal police last week. A contingent of the tribe had just completed a seven-day journey on horseback from the Bay Area to Washington, D.C., coinciding with Indigenous Peoples Day. The Muekwa Ohlone tribe says it will use Freedom of Information Act requests to investigate why it was attacked, as the group continues its campaign to restore federal recognition. Texas lawmakers heard testimony Monday in the case of death row prisoner Robert Roberson, whose execution last week was halted at the 11th hour by the Texas Supreme Court. But Roberson, who'd been subpoenaed, did not appear before the Texas House Committee after his lawyers determined it was not appropriate due to his communication challenges linked to his autism. Roberson's 2003 murder conviction was based on the shaken baby syndrome theory, which has never been scientifically validated. Among those who did testify was Terry Compton, a juror in Roberson's 2003 trial.
I started thinking back about all the things that I knew about that went on in the trial, and I just realized, and I just finally came to the conclusion, he was an innocent man. And I just, in good conscience, I could not live with myself thinking that I had a hand in putting an innocent man to death.
The Texas House panel says they will seek alternatives to hear directly from Roberson as they continue to consider his case. In Guatemala, prominent journalist Jose Rubén Zamora has been transferred from prison to house arrest after serving two of his six-year sentence behind bars. Zamora is the founder of El Periodico, which was known for its investigative reporting on corruption. He was convicted in 2022 of money laundering charges as part of then-President Alejandro Giammattei's crackdown on the press and dissent. Zamora spoke to reporters and supporters as he left Guatemala City prison on Saturday.
And I think they're going to try to lock me up again. And I want you to be certain that it may be that they are bluffing or it may be true. And if they are going to bring me back, I will wait for them at my house again. And I will come back here. I think that kind of actions are affecting them, not me.
You can see our past coverage of this case and our interview with Zamora's son at democracynow.org. And the legendary singer and activist Barbara Dane has died in her Oakland home. She died Sunday. She was 97 years old. In the 1950s, Dane became a popular blues singer, performed with many leading musicians of the time, including Louis Armstrong, Muddy Waters, Willie Dixon, and others. She eventually largely dropped out of the commercial music world to focus on social justice, becoming involved in the civil rights movement as well as the GI resistance movement during the Vietnam War. She and her husband, Irwin Sober, started the record label Paradon to release music from freedom struggles across the globe. She was one of many artists the FBI surveilled because of their activism. In 2018, Barbara Dane stopped by the Democracy Now! Studios to talk about her remarkable life and to perform a few songs.
With parking lots filled up, with playgrounds and schools, we can do what we like, because we like what we do. We'll build gardens and hospitals in every mall, and we'll stop the wars once and for all. What? Stop the wars once and for all. What? Stop the wars once and for all. Yeah, be reasonable and demand the impossible now.
Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be talking about what's happening in Gaza. To see our full interview with Barbara Dane, go to democracynow.org.
Tomorrow, another day, fortune may come your way. A thought of relief chases away the grief. Tomorrow, another day, when skies above are gray, they don't have to stay that way. A shoulder to cry on, someone to rely on. Tomorrow's another day. How sharp the pain is in my heart, how dark the future can seem. But tomorrow is a magic word filled with hope and dreams. When you're looking through your tears and things seem far away, maybe you're mistaking the changes in the making. Tomorrow's another day.
Tomorrow's another day, fortune may come your way, the thought of relief may chase away your grief, tomorrow's another day.
Barbara Dane singing Tomorrow is Another Day in our Democracy Now! Studios in 2018. She died on Sunday at the age of 97. Again, visit democracynow.org to see our full interview with her. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. The smell of death is everywhere. Those are the words of the head of the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarini, who is urging Israel to end its siege of northern Gaza. Lazzarini said, quote, "Our staff report they cannot find water, food, or medical care. The smell of death is everywhere as bodies are left lying on the roads or under the rubble. Missions to clear the bodies or provide humanitarian assistance are denied. In northern Gaza, people are just waiting to die." The words of UNRWA's Philippe Lazzarini. According to Palestinian health officials, Israeli forces have killed at least 115 Palestinians and injured nearly 500 just over the past 2 days. Israel has ordered all Palestinians to flee their homes in Beit Lahia or face a new round of attacks. One drone strike in Beit Lahia killed 15 people, including women and children.
Images and video have emerged from northern Gaza showing Israeli forces separating Palestinian men from their families and taking them away. Almost all aid has been cut off to the area as Israel implements what's been described as a surrender or starve policy. Hospitals in northern Gaza are under siege and barely able to function. This is Hassam Abu Safia, the director of the Kamel Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia.
This situation means we are under what can be called a real genocide taking place against our people in the northern Gaza Strip. The health situation has completely collapsed. The world must act immediately to secure a safe humanitarian corridor to provide blood, supplies, medicines, equipment, and medical staff, or the wounded will die in the coming few hours. Therefore, the world must understand what is happening now in the northern Gaza Strip. Genocide, deliberate killing, anyone who moves in the street is shot at. It's clear that we are witnessing a real massacre against those present. Of course, the medical staff numbers are very low, and the volume of injuries is not at all proportional to the space available. Therefore, we had to implement the difficult triage system for cases. We had to leave some to die and some to live. Therefore, our capabilities are very limited. And so the situation is catastrophic, my dear friend. The world must come now with pictures and words and images to see what is happening in the northern Gaza Strip, a real genocide against everyone who moves in the northern Gaza Strip.
That was Hassam Abu Safia, the director of Kamel Adwan Hospital. We're joined now by Mohammed Shahada, writer and analyst from Gaza City. He's chief of communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. He's joining us from Copenhagen. Mohammed, welcome back to Democracy Now! It is so critical to have you with us. As you speak with people who are in northern Gaza, the devastating, horrific images that are coming out of there under siege for more than 2 weeks. You've been in touch with a colleague of yours who is the mother of a one-year-old. Can you describe what you're hearing on the ground?
Well, it's a very close colleague of mine. She wrote me basically this morning that last night was the most violent since the war started. There was constant bombardment and shelling arbitrarily in the northern part of Gaza from 8 in the evening until 7 in the morning, nonstop. It was an airstrike or shelling literally every other second. The amount of it, the sheer intensity of it was insane. And it's been driving her very, very very worried about the survival of her family, but also suicidal by the mere thought that their turn is next at any moment. So she's saying, I'm having these thoughts about how do I keep my son and husband alive? How do I stay alive myself? Give me advice. Where to go? What should I do? How should I get food? And I cannot find any answer to any of these questions. There's literally nothing is safe and no access to food or water anymore. Israel is implementing now a strategy that is in northern Gaza premised on four different pillars, one of which is mass starvation, quite literally mass starvation. The other one is mass killing and producing mass casualties, wounded people on mass scale. And then the third one is shutting down all hospitals simultaneously so that people with these wounds are destined to die if they don't move south. And the last pillar is the mass expulsion, where you literally see Israel ordering people every day, move south, and then they literally round them up from schools and hospitals and force them to line up on a death march and move to the south. I have friends who lost family members on some of these death marches, where you have to walk for dozens of kilometers under scorching heat or in the cold without any assistant, on foot, under constant fire, fully starved with an empty stomach, and some people collapse and die on the way. I've never seen anything like this, but on the other hand, I'm seeing Israeli politicians and media celebrating the footage of these death marches with utmost glee and utmost joy that they see that this is the ultimate picture of victory. They are very open and honest that what they are doing now in northern Gaza has nothing to do with Hamas. It has everything to do with the Palestinians in there. And they say that the reason why they want to depopulate it is because Palestinians believe that displacement is 1,000 times worse than the war. It's a deliberate strategy of humiliating, terrorizing, and punishing the civilian population.
So, Mohammed, can you explain why is that? Why do Gazans think that displacement is 1,000 times worse than the war? And if you could elaborate on how the Israeli press in particular, you said a little about that now, how the Israeli press is covering the devastating conditions that you've just described in northern Gaza.
Well, basically, the reason why they find it 1,000 times worse is that as soon as you cross the line dividing Gaza, the Netzarim corridor, it's a 4 kilometers wide area that Israel has turned into a military zone, dissecting Gaza in two halves. As soon as you cross it, you will never return north again. You have to kiss your home and your loved ones goodbye. You will never see your family members that are literally just a few minutes on the other side. It's something like the Berlin War, but way more atrocious. And once you cross to the southern side, what you will find there is an insanely overcrowded tent city, just tents upon tents upon tents, surrounded by mountains of garbage and pools of sewage water, heavily infested with diseases, no protection against the weather, no protection against the rain, and just left doomed to your own fate, basically surviving off handouts, humanitarian aid that is barely coming in. So people find this as an absolute nightmare. And once you cross to the south, Israel is playing with people in the south like a ping pong, moving them around like chess pieces all the time, moving them from Deir el-Balah to Khan Yunis, and then from Khan Yunis to Mawasi, and then from Mawasi to Khan Yunis again, and back to Nusrat. It's a nonstop nightmare. And this constant instability, this constant uncertainty is one of the worst things you can do to someone that is heavily shell-shocked and traumatized and in pure survival mode. Israeli media has been very honest since at least August. So Israel's Channel 12, the most watched Israeli television, they said in August that, quote, the central victory in Gaza, the central victory is the psychological warfare that is waged upon the Gazan population in northern Gaza. Depopulating northern Gaza for them is the ultimate victory image. And they are very honest that amongst the people that will move out of northern Gaza are the Hamas members. They are not concerned with fighting Hamas in the north. They just want everybody to move out. Now, Israel's main liberal newspaper, Haaretz, has been warning since for many weeks, but yesterday they came and officially said, the editorial board, they said Netanyahu's government is now, quote, paving the way to building settlements in Gaza, building the path or facilitating the path to building Jewish-only settlements in northern Gaza after emptying it completely. So for Gaza's population to be moved into an overcrowded, unlivable tent city, pure sand and rubble and the desert, and be shell-shocked all the time and squeezed more and more and more into tinier and tinier places, it is an absolute nightmare. And that's the Israeli strategy. The reason why they adopt these strategies, what they themselves brag about, is that the images of these death marches count as a victory image for Israeli political parties and for the Israeli public to show that, look, the Palestinian public are being humiliated, are being terrorized, are being collectively punished. And with the sort of excuse that this pressure might at the end lead Gaza to either surrender or face complete demise.
And Mohammed, you know, today Antony Blinken, U.S. Secretary of State, arrived in Israel, his 11th trip to the region since October 7th, 2023. If you could say whether you think anything might come out of this trip of his. There was talk earlier, which seems obviously to be false, that once Yahya Sinwar was killed, Israel would be more open to ceasefire negotiations.
Yeah, I've been told that exact same thing repeatedly by American officials, by European officials, and people from Israel, and even Arab officials, who kept saying that if Israel manages to get Sinwar, the war would stop, or we would double or significantly increase the momentum to end the war. But as soon as Sinwar was killed, you see every single one of those people playing dumb and dead, just abandoning Gaza to its fate. These performative visits and performative declarations that there is a breakthrough, that the negotiations are happening, are just there as a pretense to buy time. There has been a deal on the table since at least July 2nd. The deal that President Biden put himself, that Hamas accepted fully on July 2nd with slight amendments in the updated formula. And Israel as well, the message that the Qataris were given, the Qataris got from the Israelis, is that Israel as well accepted that formula. And nonetheless, right after that ceasefire proposal was put on the table, Netanyahu went forth and killed the top negotiator in Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, has been unleashing one massacre after the other in Gaza and putting ludicrous terms that even his own security military establishment disagreed with completely, maintaining the occupation of Gaza in the Netzarim corridor in Philadelphia and merely having a six-week pause after which the war goes on again. So these pretenses, Blinken's visit, etc., it's there just to buy time. It's there to soothe people and pacify them and numb their outrage at what's happening and unfolding in Gaza.
Mohammed Shahad, I want to ask you about the Israeli cabinet members and officials with the ruling Likud party calling Monday for the reestablishment of Israeli settlements in Gaza and for the ethnic cleansing of the territory's Palestinian inhabitants. The far-right national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, spoke at a conference of settler groups and ultranationalists near Israel's border with Gaza. This is what he said.
We can return home to Gaza, and we can do another thing, to encourage Palestinian immigration out of Gaza. Encourage immigration. Encourage immigration. It's the best and most moral solution. Not by force, but by telling them, we're giving you the option. Leave to other countries. The land of Israel is ours.
So if you can talk about the significance of this, Mohammed Shahada, he was then cheered after he said this. And also talk about whether you think that Netanyahu right now is pushing for a war with Iran that would serve the U.S. election to get Trump elected, his true ally.
Yes, absolutely. So in terms of Iran and Netanyahu's ambition, yesterday, Israel's top right-wing journalist, Amit Sigal, he said it openly and publicly that we want Trump to be back because if he is back in office, Israel will get away with annexing major parts of the Gaza Strip and will get away with as much, for instance, in Lebanon or vis-a-vis the Iranians. He is actively trying to sabotage Kamala Harris's campaign. It's no secret. But in terms of the Israeli security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, the U.S., every time that point is raised to them, they try to dismiss it or downplay it by saying this is a fringe minority in Netanyahu's government. No, it's not. Now you have at least half of Netanyahu's ruling coalition that are officially, openly in favor of such plan of depopulating Gaza's half and building settlements there and taking over and annexing parts of it. But the other half, the sort of silent half in Netanyahu's cabinet, many of them are also in that direction. Even people in the Israeli opposition, now you have the Israeli political map vis-a-vis Gaza, is fragmented between three different preferences. Number one is the one you mentioned, Amy, about resettling the Gaza Strip, building Jewish-only settlements in Gaza. Number two is the Netanyahu preference, building an Israeli military government, a military dictatorship to rule the Gaza Strip for the foreseeable future. And if the world is not happy with that, then a joint Arab or joint international mission to do Israel's dirty work in Gaza, to pay for Gaza's sustaining life in Gaza on a humanitarian scale and do the sort of dismantling, disarmament of Hamas. And number three, the defense establishment, the moderate position and the opposition position is that Israel will rule Gaza militarily for the the foreseeable future. A military occupation will stay in Gaza, but they don't want to do anything with Gaza's civilian aspect of governance. They want to outsource it to anybody else so that they don't have to pay anything for running Gaza. And you heard, for example, Israel's former defense minister, Benny Gantz, who's supposed to be the opposition to Netanyahu, a moderate, relatively speaking, as soon as Sinwar was killed, he said, we will stay in Gaza for the foreseeable future. So this is a very scary spectrum that you have on hand that is setting forth the agenda for an indefinite war. And the only reason you can sort of change that, influence a change in there, is by basically pressuring Israel and cutting off the weapon supply without conditioning the weapon supply or cutting it off. There's no hope of any positive alternative coming out of this.
Mohammed, before we end, we just have a minute. We would like to ask about your family. You recently saw in Egypt both your grandmother and your cousin. You say people who've even managed to get out look like ghosts of their former selves. If you could tell us what it was like, how your grandmother and your cousin appeared to you.
Well, it's a thought that I have to wrestle with all the time, is that the Gaza that I know is gone, and it's not just the loved ones that were killed. I stopped counting how many I lost. And it's not just the homes that were bombed, but it's the physical debilitation, the physical weakening of the people in Gaza, even the ones that came out of it. I got a message from my mom when my grandmother came out, and she said, by the look of it, your grandma's not going to be here for long. You have to come immediately and see her. I went to see her. She was, before the war, she was this healthy, beautiful woman with a lot of jewelry in her hands, and she was very proud, traditional Palestinian clothing all the time. Now she was just mere skin and bone, with her feet swollen up in a very frightening way, and complications with the digestive system, nonstop, and she was bedridden completely incapacitated. I saw my cousin on the street, who was also a healthy, tall, beautiful woman in Gaza with smooth skin. That was her reputation, how she is seen in the family. I saw her in the street. I didn't recognize her. She did. And basically, she had shrunken. Her back is arched. She was skin on bone, a shorter person than the one I'm used to, with curled up skin, very darkened skin, very rough skin. And I couldn't recognize her anymore. And I fear for the same fate of everyone I know in Gaza, that they have been changed and turned into ghosts physically, but also the mental debilitation. Before this war started, you had about 90% of Gaza's population with PTSDs and 70% with persistent depressive disorder symptoms. Now it's way, way, way uglier than that. Now I hear suicidal thoughts from everyone I know. And Gaza is religiously, culturally religious. There is the belief that suicide is the gateway to eternity in hell. But what Israel has done in Gaza is that it's now pushing people to believe that God's hell, no matter what, is going to be way better than the nightmare that is inflicted on Gaza.
Mohammed Shahada, we want to thank you for being with us, writer and analyst, originally from Gaza City, chief of communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, speaking to us today from Copenhagen. When we come back, we'll be joined by the acclaimed writer and activist Naomi Klein. She'll discuss her new essay, How Israel Has Made Trauma a Weapon of War, as well as how conspiracy theories are impacting everything from the U.S. presidential election to hurricane relief. She writes about conspiracies in her book, now out in paperback, Doppelganger, A Trip into the Mirror World. Back in 20 seconds.
Rubber bullets for the ladies, catch them in the CS can. 3 inches wide, 6 inches long, take it home to your oil man. It's an instrument of torture to break your legs in two. It'll stop you feeling lonely, but leave you black and blue. When you've had your fill of CS gas behind the barricade and served your time with half bricks, you've learnt a brand new trade. Aye, you're fighting for your freedom, the dignity of man. Look out for rubber bullets. It's the army's latest plan. Rubber bullets for the ladies, catch them in the CS can. 3 inches wide, 6 inches long, take it home to your oil man. It's an instrument of torture to break your legs in two. It'll stop you feeling lonely, but leave you black and blue. And if your army's going hungry, curfew needn't break your heart. The army solved your problem, you can bake a rubber tart. When you're under house arrest and your nerves are getting red, the prescription's rubber bullets fired from underneath the bed. Rubber bullets for the ladies, catch them in the CS can. 3 inches.
inches wide, 6 inches.
Rubber Bullets, sung by the Men of No Property in Belfast, released by Paradon Records, co-founded by the late, great Barbara Dane. She passed away Sunday at the age of 97. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
As we continue our coverage of Israel's war on Gaza, we turn now to look at how Israel has made trauma a weapon of war. That's the headline to a recent essay in The Guardian by our next guest, the award-winning journalist and author Naomi Klein, who examines how memorials to the October 7th attacks have stirred support for Israel's limitless violence. She writes, quote, "It's a simple fable of good and evil in which Israel is unblemished in its innocence, deserving unquestioning support, while its enemies are all monsters deserving of violence unbounded by laws or borders, whether in Gaza, Jenin, Beirut, Damascus, or Tehran."
Naomi Klein is professor of climate justice at the University of British Columbia, the founding co-director of the UBC Center for Climate Justice. Her latest book, Doppelganger, A Trip into the Mirror World, is now available in paperback. She's the author of many other books, including The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Naomi, it's great to have you back in our New York studio, but horrifying during these times. If you can respond first to what's happening on the ground in Gaza, in Lebanon, and then if you can relate it to this piece that you just wrote for The Guardian.
Sure. Well, I think the first thing that we need to understand, and I think we have seen this in the clips and in your previous interview, is that though the Israeli government likes to frame everything that is happening now as a response to October 7th, this is a pre-existing agenda. I mean, this is the settler movement, Ben-Gavir, I mean, all of these figures have always wanted Gaza depopulated. They've always wanted to settle Gaza. They've always believed it is part of so-called Greater Israel. So does Netanyahu. It's part of their coalition agreement dating back to 2022, right, that they want the whole thing, and also the West Bank, by the way. So, you know, I've written before about how states of shock are often exploited very cynically to ram through a pre-existing agenda. And I think that's absolutely what we're seeing. But in order for that to work, the state of shock needs to be continued, heightened. There can never be a recovery. So the Israeli society needs to be reshocked and kept in this kind of trauma loop. And that's what this piece about the kind of trauma industry is about. And I want to be very clear, people have a right to grieve their loved ones. This is not about families gathering in grief. This is not about the right to remember and honor. It's about state-orchestrated and manipulated trauma. It's memorialization from above, right? Not from below. For a very specific end. And people in the Netanyahu government have been very clear that really what they're doing with the way they are telling the story of October 7th is creating what they call a new national identity. And it's a national identity that uses the trauma of that day to create a story that fuses October 7th with the Holocaust, and then uses that as the excuse for the genocide that we're seeing right now. So, you know, when we think about the horrors that you've already outlined today on the show, and frankly every show, right, the deliberate starvation, the torment of an entire population, the torture of an entire population, the deliberate humiliation, how do you, and I think we all ask ourselves this question, how are people able to rationalize it, right? And they're able to rationalize it because within their information bubbles, they are being fed this constant story of this is what they did to you, a whole industry of re-experiencing it. I mean, what I write about in this piece is all of these immersive so-called memorialization kind of technologies. So it's not only people in Israel, but in the diaspora who are encouraged to put on VR goggles and re-experience October 7th as if it happened to them, immersive tunnels where you can go into the Gaza tunnels. it's really an attempt to transfer trauma far and wide. In a state of trauma, you don't really think. It's pure emotion. It's pure reaction. You can't be analytical. You're not going to be empathetic towards others. It's about monsterizing the other and fusing your identity with the people, you know, in those houses, at the Nova Music Festival, in the tunnels. It's very deliberate. It's extremely manipulative. And it's how you turn off any compassion or empathy or sense of ethics or morals.
And just to be clear, you point out that a number of hostage family members, in response to the state memorializations, as you put it, on October 7th, said, do not use our family members' names. We don't want to be a part of this, as they fight for their family members to be released and a ceasefire, an end to Palestinian anguish.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the way in which the government is weaponizing, instrumentalizing the deaths on October 7th and the hostages. The people who are most opposed to it are the families themselves, right? So what I begin the piece with the fact that originally the government's plans for October 7th was to have this huge public event in the South. There were going to be thousands of people, I think 7,000 people, and they wanted to have, you know, members of the families there to testify. And kibbutz after kibbutz, that was really, you know, on the front line, like kibbutzim, like Be'eri, said, we're not participating in this. Then family members said, not only are we not participating, you can't use our child's name, you can't use their, you know, their image, which is not to say that they're not grieving. They had their own private, dignified ceremonies, vigils, you know, for people who are still alive. They just didn't want any part of the pageantry and the weaponization of the government. They didn't, you know, and that was withheld. You know, of course, the way my piece has been responded to through the sort of Hasbara channels is, you know, Naomi Klein says we don't have a right to grieve, ignoring the fact that it's the families themselves who have the most to grieve, who are actually objecting the loudest within Israeli society.
And if you could say, Naomi, you know, you just mentioned, which your piece talks about at length, the conflation of October 7th with the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. First of all, what that makes possible,
right.
Some of the examples of the ways in which that's happened through these different memorialization practices that you outline, and then whether an argument can be made for whether this is not precisely kind of a trivialization mm-hmm. of the Holocaust, a kind of banalization of it, which is precisely what survivors and scholars of the Holocaust warned against.
Right. Yeah, I think it's extraordinary because one of the things that is happening from the same people who are trivializing the Holocaust in this way, they're also, if you say what's happening in Gaza is a genocide, you know, they'll throw their arms up in horror and say, you know, that is impossible. Despite the immense scale and the deliberate plans and the, you know, all of the markers, the announcements of intent, and I'm not going to go into that, but they think nothing of saying that that October 7th was as if 80 years had not passed, as if it was not another continent, as if it was not another group of people, as if the power dynamics were not flipped on their head, that this day just grafts onto the Holocaust, as if it was 1945. And so this goes from everything from the Shoah Foundation adding another chapter. So the Shoah Foundation, which is, you know, an incredibly important archive of testimonies of Holocaust survivors, now has added testimonies from survivors of October 7th. March of the Living tours of Auschwitz, now you hear from survivors of October 7th. So it's a total conflation of these events. You know, in the piece, I tell a kind of extreme story of they call it an art project. I wouldn't call it an art project, but it was a bizarre kind of stunt of creating a juxtaposition of the iconic memorial to the victims of the Holocaust in Berlin and hanging a pair of mocked up, bloodied pants that were to symbolize sexual violence on October 7th and suspending them over those that memorial with drones to say and then saying never again question mark as if this is all the same event. Now, I mean, you asked about, well, what are the implications of this? The implications are that if you do conflate these events, of course, it justifies any response, right? And more than that, if you cast Palestinians as Nazis, if you create this continuum, this absolutely false continuum, then it actually post facto does a lot more work than that, because then if Palestinians are Nazis, then the original crime in the creation of the State of Israel, which is the Nakba, which is the mass forced ethnic cleansing, displacement of hundreds of thousands, more than 700,000 Palestinians, who had nothing to do with the Holocaust, is like after the fact justified, right? So if they're Nazis, then the original crime that Israel can't look at in its founding is sort of after the fact justified. This is the psychology of it. Of course, it makes no sense, but this is why it's very dangerous, and it's why we're seeing this acceleration of kind of finish the job Nakba from Israeli politicians.
Well, I want to ask, Naomi, one of the people that you cite in your piece, I mean, on the question of grief and grieving, is the historian Gabriel Winant, whose piece in Dissent, which you take from, is headlined on mourning and statehood. It was a response to Joshua Liefer, a journalist in the same journal in Dissent. But I'd like to read a short excerpt. This is not what you quote, but it's from his original piece. He writes, "The genuine, humane sentiment that it is possible to grieve equally for those on both sides is tragically not true. One side has an enormous grief machine, the best in the world, up and running, feeding on bodies and tears and turning them into bombs. The other is starved for grief." Mm-hmm. Now, Gabriel wrote that piece less than 1 week after October 7th. Now it's over a year, over 42,000 Gazans killed. If you could elaborate on this, because this is something that people have struggled with, you know, because as you said earlier, people have a right to grieve what happened on October 7th, and yet there is this massive discrepancy.
Massive asymmetry in who's grievable, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is Butler's term, Judith Butler's term, that within a vastly unequal white supremacist society, you have lives that are more treated as more grievable than others. And so many justice struggles are about asserting that every life is grievable. And so, I mean, the Black Lives Matter movement is about about asymmetrical grief in so many ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, personally, I think there's sometimes this idea that you can tell people not to grieve because, you know, to sort of balance the scales. I don't think grief is a very obedient emotion from my experience. It's highly disobedient and unruly. And I think it is dangerous, actually, to tell people that they can't have the emotions that they're having. I think it's more constructive to try to redirect those emotions into a project that is liberatory, that is in solidarity, you know, create containers for grief that are not the weaponized containers or instrumentalized containers that are using that grief and turning it into a justification for genocide. So, you know, I have respect but disagreement with that position. But we need to wrestle with it. You know, in the piece, I also quote a scholar, a Lebanese Australian scholar, Ghassan Hajj, who talks about how he felt this pressure to grieve those deaths in a certain way after October 7th, in a way that he described as supremacist mourning, which had encoded in it the idea that these lives were more important, more precious than Palestinian lives, Lebanese lives, and that's what we must reject on all counts. The other thing that's been pointed out many times is that you can't really mourn when the bodies are still piling up, when there are bodies still under the rubble, when in cities are being turned to dust. Mourning is something actually that you do once it's over, and it's not over.
You also quote Marion Hirsch, a professor emerita at Columbia University, and you end your piece by applauding the group, Israeli-Palestinian group, Zachrot, which means remembering. Talk about both.
Yeah, I mean, Marianne Hirsch is a wonderful scholar of different forms of memorialization and the way in which these sort of top-down, this top-down pageantry memorial creates the a false experience, a sort of a, she doesn't use this term, but a prosthetic trauma. The remembering, you know, if you break down the parts of the word remembering, it's really putting the pieces of the self back together again. And the work of Zohorot, which is, you know, they've been doing work for many years, which is really about putting the pieces, like Israel is based on erasure, right? Erasing the presence of every settler colonial state, the United States, Canada, Australia, they're all about erasing the original indigenous presence there, renaming towns, denying that there are burial grounds. So it's actually the opposite of memorialization that happens. And so what would real remembering mean, you know, in violent settler colonial states? And it would be actually putting the pieces of the self back together again, which is this deeper form of remembering.
We want to pivot for a moment. As you travel the United States, your book is out, Doppelganger, in paperback, and the presidential election 2 weeks away, though millions upon millions of people have already voted. Mm-hmm. Kamala Harris, Donald Trump continuing to campaign in the battleground states. At a recent rally in Erie, Pennsylvania, Vice President Harris denounced Trump's calls to confront what he calls the enemy from within and played clips of Trump's recent speeches.
He tells us what he would do if he is elected president. So here tonight, I will show you one example of Donald Trump's worldview and intentions. Please roll the clip.
The worst people are the enemies from within.
The enemy from within. Those people are more dangerous, the enemy from within, than Russia and China.
These people should be put in jail the way they talk about our judges and our justices.
Now, if you had one really violent day, one rough hour, and I mean real rough.
I think the bigger problem are the people from within. We have some very bad people. We have some sick people, radical left lunatics. And I think they're the big, and it should be very easily handled by, if necessary, by National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military.
Coming from him. He's talking about the enemy within Pennsylvania.
Meanwhile, former President Trump literally cursed when he talked about Kamala Harris during a campaign rally in Pennsylvania.
And this one, Kamala is further left than them. So you have to tell Kamala Harris that you've had enough, that you just can't take it anymore. We can't stand you. You're a vice president.
Let's just say his word rhymed with hit. Harris responded by saying Trump's language, quote, demeans the office. Naomi Klein, if you can respond to this and then move into the conspiracy theories. You have people like Trump and Elon Musk who are saying things like in Michigan they have more voters than residents. But talk about it all. The word stupid Trump uses repeatedly all the time when describing Harris as well.
Well, it's extraordinarily racist. I think it's really important that people take him at his word when he issues these threats, because the whole campaign, it's built on a combination of sort of hate he can deliver on and economic fantasies he will not deliver on, right? I mean, he's not going to make everything perfect after he's elected. Everybody isn't going to be able to afford homes. Everybody isn't going to have great-paying factory jobs. So the economic side is always a fantasy. But he has to deliver on something, which is why last time the things that he delivered on very quickly, right, were the sort of easy, like the Muslim ban, you know, or... You know, there's certain things he can do on climate that are very tangible, right? So one of the first things he did last time was give approval for pipelines that had been, you know, suspended. And he'll, you know, he's promised oil companies that he would undo every single bit of climate legislation and give them huge tax breaks and so on. So he's saying it's a great investment. Give me $1 billion and you'll get many back, you know, many billions back more. That's the kind of stuff he can deliver on, right? So I think that when you are telling people wild things that you absolutely cannot deliver on, when they're saying that, and also there's going to be violence and repression, that is very important that he will deliver on that, because he has to deliver on something. He can't go and say, you know, sorry, I didn't do any of it. So it's that easy stuff. It's that absolute punching down. It's that sort of pleasure of at least you're able to dominate, at least you're able to release. And he, you know, if we look at what hard right sort of strong arm figures around the world have done when they've had that kind of power, they do that. So I think, I am not a fan of Harris's campaign, the choices she's made. I think she's running an extremely high-risk, dangerous campaign because she is trying to win without the base. And she's sending a message to that base that, sorry, you know, I'm more interested in Liz Cheney and Dick Cheney and getting Republicans than I am interested in listening to Palestinians, to Muslims, to Arabs, to the left generally, to the anti-war forces. She's told us we're irrelevant. And Trump is telling us that he's going to round us up. So this is, nobody would want this election, but we've got to be smart.
Well, you, in fact, just to go back, on Saturday you spoke here in New York on a panel called Beyond the Ballot, The Left in a Time of Polycrisis, and you spoke about Kamala Harris's decision, or the campaign's decision, to focus on joy. So joy in this moment, if you could elaborate why you think that was a problematic choice.
Yeah, well, what I said there is that I think that they were confusing relief with joy. So, you know, that early sort of cathartic release after Joe Biden finally stepped down and people were, you know, dancing in the streets, they thought that was, you know, a genuine reaction to what Harris represented, when I think it was just like a massive exhale. And that people don't feel joy right now. People are, dealing with very heavy doses of reality, whether it is the genocide in Gaza, whether it's having their towns pummeled by climate events, whether it's not being able to afford the basics of life. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that it's wealthier, well-educated people who are still resonating with Harris, and it's people who are closest to the pain going, what are you talking about? You know, this is not a joyful moment. You've got to earn our joy, right? You mentioned the conspiracies that are happening. You know, this is really a continuation of the COVID sort of infrastructure of disinformation and misinformation that got very, very strong in the COVID lockdowns. A lot of really sort of powerful information pathways were opened up. Once the health, once the public health measures were lifted, there were a lot of people looking for, you know, what's going to be the next liftoff, what's going to be the next issue that's going to get all the clicks that they can monetize and so on. And now climate disasters are really providing that. So it's everything from, you know, climate change itself is presented as a hoax by the Davos elites in order to lock you in your home to eat bugs. But then they have to deal with the fact that people are encountering weather events that are very unnatural. So what's the story for that? It's the government who's manipulating the weather. Why is the government manipulating the weather? Because they want to drown red states. Aren't they responding? Because they don't want people to vote. And also, they've given the money to migrants. So it's sort of a singularity of all the conspiracies. Who else? Who's really behind it? It's the Jews. I mean, it's a whole mess of contradictory conspiracies.
And in this last 30 seconds, Elon Musk and his role right now, the richest man on Earth, saying he'll give $1 million out daily to voters.
That's the real conspiracy, Amy. That's the conspiracy in plain view. And the thing about this sort of wild, you know, I call it conspiracy culture because it isn't a theory. What it is a distraction machine. It's a smoke machine that's just keeping us from looking at the conspiracies that we can prove, that investigative journalists have proved, that are out in the open, like Trump saying, give me $1 billion to the oil companies and I'll roll back environmental regulations that will drive more hurricanes to your front door, everyone, right? Or Elon Musk, whose entire business model is just about getting, you know, subsidies from the government and, you know, buying a platform that one man should never have been allowed to own, you know, our information commons. They, of course, they want us distracted with this nonsense, because if we weren't distracted with that, then that deep sense that something is not well and that we really have deep problems to solve would be directed up at them. So they always have to direct it down. That's also why we have to be concerned about Trump. He will always direct that. He will harness that rage and he will direct it at the most vulnerable.
Naomi Klein, professor of climate justice, University of British Columbia. Her book is just out, Doppelganger, A Trip into the Mirror World. It's in paperback.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
You are tuning into WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. I'm Kate, and on this episode of Forbes Ave, we will be exploring dialectics, or two seemingly opposing ideas that exist at once. I would like to introduce you to our guest today, Jaden Singh, a wonderful fine artist, computer science student at CMU who absolutely makes the most of getting outdoors. Here, we have a lot of questions for you today. Last year, you biked all the way home from Pittsburgh to DC during fall break. Can you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like?
That experience was really awesome. Probably one of my favorite memories from last year. And that was even... It's mid-October, of course, so the leaves are going off, and you're biking through southern Pennsylvania and northern Maryland at these elevations where the leaves are just beautiful. You got the rolling mountains in the background and this really beautiful river. It was raining for a good portion of it, and that didn't even detract too much, which I think speaks to how much I enjoyed the trail. It was my first time biking over 15 miles, I think, and it was... an 80-mile day, 40 miles, 150 because I had to catch up, and then 70 to take me home. And I think that was a really cool part about it, is I had no idea what was going to happen going into it, got on the trail, figured out, all right, this is pretty cool, and then just went the distance. And yeah, it was really lovely.
So you'd consider yourself a spontaneous person?
I think so. I sometimes surround myself with people who are even more spontaneous that make me think that maybe I'm not, but I think if you ask a lot of people that know me, they'd say so, judging by how I spend my weekends.
Yeah, like, I know you mentioned that Wyoming is a second home, and those people from Wyoming are those people that you work in the Park Service. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and that community, I guess it grew a lot last summer, because the first two summers I was working there with this youth corps that was working in Grand Teton National Park. And so I knew a lot of the kids. I didn't really know so many of the adults, and we were like sort of adjacent to the Park Service, but I didn't get to know too many of the true like professional crew people. But last summer I was with the adult crew, got to know a lot of people who have worked in the Park Service for a long time, and they taught me a lot. It was my first time spending all my time with people that much older than me, because my specific crew, I mean, we worked building trails, and they divide, I think, 20 to 25 people into maybe four or five groups of four to six people. I had a six-person crew, and I was the youngest, and I think my boss was 38, and most people who work in trails are mid-20s, late-20s. I think that would be the median. And so that's such a different perspective. They're in a different stage of life, and you get a lot of maturity. But also really the cool thing about trails is with the youth crew and then also with the National Park Service is that you spend so much time with them. You live with them for about a month out in the woods, so you'll get to know them whether you want to or not, and you'll be cooking together and cleaning together and having fun together, unless you tuck yourself away in your tent the whole time, but no one does that. Well, no one on my crew really did that. And I think with a youth crew, now that I've known some of those people for 3 years, because I went back and I got to see a couple of them, those are really very important relationships to me. They've helped me out a lot, because my first 2 summers there, I came there knowing no one nowhere to stay a lot of the time, just no structure. And I mean, they didn't even always have structure, but they knew people and they were always willing to help me. And I really appreciated that, and I still try and keep in touch. And in general, they're also just really interesting people. Because I'm from D.C., and I don't feel like I left home too much